This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Welcome to a special Press Play on KCRW, California's Clout in 2020. We're in Long Beach at the Democratic Party convention in front of a live audience. Today, we'll explore California's role in the 2020 Democratic primary and how the state's primary on March 3rd gives California more clout than ever before in picking the party's nominee. Joining us today is Josh Barrow, business columnist at New York Magazine and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center.
Hi, Madeline.
Nominee Const, a former Bernie Sanders surrogate. She's board director at Matriarch. That's a new PAC aiming to increase the number of progressive working women in office.
Hello, Madeline.
And Gustavo Arellano is here, features writer for Los Angeles Times and a frequent contributor to KCRW.
Hola, Madeline.
Okay, it's great to have you all here. I want to just begin with a general question which goes at the conceit of this entire show, and that is the importance of California, California's clout. So the primary is March 3rd. There are 416 delegates at stake. And I guess the question is, will it work? Will California now have more say this election than it has in previous elections? Let's begin with Josh.
Well, I think it depends a lot on what happens in the first four states to vote, because, I mean, the process that we have leading up to Super Tuesday with California and so many other states voting at the beginning of March, obviously we'll go through Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. And so you can imagine a scenario where one candidate has won all or most of those states and then rolls in with momentum. And while the campaign will not be decided before Super Tuesday, it's likely that those early state wins will give a person a lot of momentum. The only Democratic nominee who has won the nomination in recent history without winning either Iowa or New Hampshire was Bill Clinton in 1992. And that's sort of an example that doesn't even really count, because Senator Tom Harkin ran for president in 1992, so nobody really contested the Iowa caucuses that year. So in general, you know, there's a lot of power in winning Iowa or New Hampshire, especially winning both of them. Now, there are two flip sides to that. One is that we have such a fragmented field this time. And the other is there's this growing disconnect in the Democratic Party where something like 40% of the electorate will be non-white, but Iowa and New Hampshire are so very white. And so at some point there has to be a bit of a breakdown between two principles, which are that Iowa and New Hampshire decide who's going to be the nominee and that non-white voters have enormous influence in determining who's going to be the nominee. So this would be a better year than normal for there to be someone to come from behind without winning Iowa and New Hampshire. But I still think, you know, if we're looking very fragmented coming out of those states, then California's going to be very important, but it's possible it'll be wrapped up before we get here.
What do you think, Gustavo?
I think California has, for the past, since 2016, really set itself as the home of the resistance. Iowa and New Hampshire are not the resistance. California is. So I could definitely see you might have other states going with other candidates, but with California, I don't know if, say, if it's a Biden or a Buttigieg who wins these earlier seats, that California voters would necessarily go for them. They're still probably going to go with their Bernie or, or Warren, probably not Kamala at this point, but I think they're still going to hold on to those progressive values.
Well, there is another wrinkle to that, and that is California voters like to mail in their ballots. And the mail-in ballots will be sent out on the very same day as the Iowa caucuses, on February 3rd.
A whole month before.
So it's conceivable that they'll see what happens in Iowa. Maybe they see what happens in New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, and they vote before the primary.
Yeah, if one person collects the first three states, as Josh mentioned, yes, it could influence California through the early mail-ins or even on the day of the primary. With that being said, I personally think that California will be very important this election, but not for the reasons that many thought initially. California, it was a little controversial when they moved up their primary. Initially, you know, it was in June last time around, and now it's in March. California is a very expensive state. It has very expensive media markets, and traditionally candidates that have more money do better in expensive states with expensive media markets. This time around, though, the candidates with the most money happen to be Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, and they have collected that money through small dollar contributions, without corporate money, without Southern California big dollar fundraisers and Hamptons fundraisers. So I don't know if that was by design by the California Democratic Party to move it up, but that was one of the concerns that people had. So if, for instance, Senator Sanders picks up, you know, one state, New Hampshire, this is an exercise, and Senator Warren picks up, you know, Nevada, and Kamala Harris picks up South Carolina, and of course, you know, Biden picks up, or Buttigieg picks up Iowa. You could have a very interesting scenario with California splitting because it's not a winner-take-all state. And so on Super Tuesday, we could have a four-way race, or we could have a one-way race. It's really hard to tell.
I'm going to be interested to see about those mail-in ballots because, I mean, in a general election, most voters are partisans. Even most people who call themselves independents vote always or almost always for one party. So you can look at your ballot 5 weeks ahead of the general election, know what your preferences are going to be on election day, and send that ballot in early. But when you look at polling in this primary, the numbers of voters who say they have a candidate preference but that they might vote for someone else are enormous. You'll see things like in some primary poll, you'll see that Elizabeth Warren has this percentage, but literally 70% of those respondents say it's possible that they will vote for somebody else. So I suspect you'll have some voters who are very attached to one candidate and they'll be happy to send that ballot in early. But I kind of expect that you'll see a lot of people holding on to those ballots longer than they normally would in California because they're waiting to make up their mind and maybe because they are waiting to see the results from some of the earlier states.
Are they waiting for more candidates to jump in?
No. We have enough already. Too many.
I think the consultants are waiting. They're like, oh, another paycheck? Sure.
Voters are more satisfied with this candidate field than in previous campaigns. When you look in the polls, the discontent with this field, it's not there among the voters. It is there among certain elements of the donor class and the consultant class. And I don't think it's purely about not wanting a candidate who's so far to the left, although I think that's part of it. But I mean, you know, there is the big moderate candidate in the field who's Joe Biden, who has been in the lead on the national polls the entire time. There were a few polls over the last 6 weeks or so that had Warren in the lead, but still we're seeing Biden in the lead in almost all the national polls. And so you would think if you are a worried member of the Democratic establishment who wants someone more centrist with demonstrated appeal in general election polling, that you'd go with Joe Biden. Everyone seems convinced that he's just, you know, one step away from falling apart, but they've been convinced of that for months, and his poll lead in the national polls is persistent.
Well, and just on that note, you know, these early states are about enthusiasm, especially states like New Hampshire, which is an open primary. You have independents and Republicans who can vote in that primary. And in Iowa, it is about enthusiasm. It's who can excite their base enough. And he, at this point in the last filings, which we'll talk about later, has $9 million in the bank right now. This is Biden, the centrist, the corporate Democrat. They had to set up a super PAC so that his big donors who maxed out could help out on the side. And I think that's where Pete Buttigieg sees an opportunity. And we've seen him move more to the center and pick up
that. He is now polling number one in Iowa.
And in the latest, you know, just to show how crazy these polls are right now, in the latest national poll, Bernie Sanders came in the lead. So it is extremely close, and we are still 2 months away, more than 2 months away, from Iowa.
So what does Deval Patrick do in this race? What does it do? What does he do to
Nothing.
This race? Michael Bloomberg.
Nothing. At this point, there's no enthusiasm for these people. It's Johnny come latelys. And I think there's a lot of enthusiasm about this, but I think the key thing for the Democrats at this point, all these candidates who have all their fan bases, tell everyone, if I don't win, you fall in line with whoever's going to win. This is what we need. And I hope that happens, at least for, you know, for the sake of the Democrats.
You know, my theory on Patrick, and this might be like, I mean, this is how we have to exercise at this point. It's like conspiracy land because we don't know. I think that there are certain donors in the Democratic Party and supporters of the Democratic Party who want to have as many securities in place in case of a Warren or a Bernie coming along. And if it does become a contested convention, it becomes, what happens is you have several candidates, and if one is not chosen on the first ballot of the convention, you move to the second ballot. And in the second ballot, suddenly all bets are off. It becomes, you know, the superdelegates come back, which we eliminated after 2016. They come in and they get to choose whoever they want. And if Biden does not have enough money to go past South Carolina, and if Pete Buttigieg is not a strong enough candidate because he's a mayor of a medium-sized, you know, city in America, maybe some people don't think he's strong enough to take it to the White House, then Barack Obama has openly said that he would like to see a Deval Patrick as president.
Speaking of Barack Obama, he said yesterday, the average American doesn't think we have to completely tear down the system and remake it. He was basically talking to a room full of pretty wealthy Democratic donors and basically saying, look, don't get too excited about Warren and Sanders because that's not where the American electorate is.
Well, I think there's evidence for this. Alan Abramowitz, who's a political scientist at Emory, looked at competitive congressional races. About half the Democrats who ran for Congress in the 2018 cycle endorsed single-payer health care. He found that on average that cost them 4.5 points in the margin in their races. Now, it was a very good year for Democrats. So obviously you saw a lot of Democrats who were for single-payer win, sometimes even in competitive districts like Katie Porter. But in general, yes, there was a penalty associated with that. The polling on it depends a lot on what you tell people about how the system will work. They don't like it when you tell them that it's going to take away private insurance. They don't like it when you tell them that it involves new taxes. Those are things you end up having to discuss as you get farther into the campaign. So I think there's that to worry about. And then there's also some more cultural issues. Nate Cohn has done some very interesting polling on this at the New York Times, looking at these persuadable voters, people who tell pollsters that they would vote for some Democratic candidates over Trump, but not others. And it seems to be a mix of more affluent voters who have a problem with single payer and socialism and those sorts of things, and non-college educated voters, including a substantial number of non-white men who seem to have more cultural concerns about the Democratic Party and who are more favorable toward Donald Trump than you might expect.
But their second choice is Bernie Sanders, which is actually pretty astounding. So I think, you know, these theories are yet to be exercised. And, you know, the same statement, Barack Obama also said that the Democrats need to be focusing on winning. And, you know, I'm on the left, so I can say this openly. Barack Obama was the head of the Democratic Party during the tenure that the Democrats lost 1,200 seats. So something I think for a lot of Democrats across the country needs to change. And, you know, there's the Democratic primary, and there are different demographics in different districts. I mean, if you look at millennials in California, the Latino population, and compare that to, you know, the upper white middle class in Orange County, California, those are two different Democratic parties that are in opposition with each other. So demographics are going to play a lot into the future of the Democratic Party, especially as millennials become the major voting bloc.
You have perfectly teed us up for our next segment, which we're going to talk about that a lot more in the next segment. We're going to talk about issues that are important to young voters, issues that are important to Latinx voters. We're going to talk about this suburban-urban divide, whether or not the districts that went blue this last midterm election will be able to stay blue. All of that is coming up when our special broadcast from the California Democratic Party convention continues, coming up next on Press Play.